Morning, everybody, on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us on this Labor Day weekend. In 2012, Maryland became the first state to pass a same-sex marriage bill by voter referendum. Earlier this summer, the tide toward marriage equality shifted decidedly when the Supreme Court ruled that all states must allow gay marriage. Now, a conversation about the history of the gay rights movement in Baltimore in the decades leading up to these major developments. In a new book in Arcadia Publishing's series of pictorial histories, the author and activist Louise Parker Kelly chronicles the social, cultural, and political story of Baltimore's gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. The book is called LGBT Baltimore. Louise Parker Kelly joins me in the studio along with Kurt Decker, civil rights lawyer who is the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. He's been a gay activist in Baltimore and on the national scene for more than 30 years. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello, Tom.
And Kurt, it's good to have you back. And Louise, it's nice to meet you. So Louise, you talk about three transformative moments in the LGBT scene in Baltimore. What are the three sort of milestones here in Baltimore?
I would say the first milestone is probably in 1975 when Baltimore Gay Alliance began, and possibly Metropolitan Community Church in 1972. Those two were organizations, so there was somewhere for people to go who were out. But the next thing that happened was that there became a national conversation that affected Baltimore, so that people were able to come out. And come out became a phrase that everybody used in all kinds of contexts later. But it was the biggest step, I think, that the community took. And it was a big deal in Baltimore because it was a conservative, blue-collar, very heavily Catholic city. So, for example, when we first went to get the rights bill passed in 1979, Archbishop Borders.
This is a city ordinance that
eventually passed,
but took three tries.
Yeah. Right. To amend the civil rights legislation that was already in place to add sexual orientation. And Archbishop Borders decided that it was not okay with him, and he came out against it. And that was one of the first waves of political organization that woke everybody up, because the expectation was that, oh, well, many cities have passed this, so Baltimore will. And then people became more organized. GLCC began. GLCCB is the Gay and Lesbian Community Center of Baltimore. Has a lot more initials now, but that's the way people usually refer to it. And when it began in 1977, we had lots of services suddenly. A switchboard for people who were coming out, especially gay youth who were very much at risk. The STD clinic was part of the community center. It's now the Chase Brexton Clinic. The gay paper and just endless numbers of groups that became support groups. Mm-hmm. And we also had fun. We had drag shows. We had Halloween parties. We were able to find each other.
And Kurt Decker, back in 1980, you helped organize a fundraiser for the Gay Community Center. And this business that Louise is talking about, with people gradually coming out in larger numbers, back in the 70s and the early 80s, it was not such an easy thing for gay people to do.
Absolutely. I think younger people today forget, with all of the attention and public media on gay and bisexual and transgendered issues, that back in the late 70s, 80s, even though, as Louise said, there were this beginning of all these services, there was still an incredible amount of fear. We had that first fundraiser in 1980, sold a lot of tickets, and when people approached the aquarium, there were Klieg lights and press to film it, and many of the people just turned away and went home. They just couldn't really bring themselves to go into that kind of public limelight yet. And of course, that was, you know, the very beginnings of trying to get people to feel comfortable that we had to organize and be seen in order to achieve our rights.
As the AIDS crisis grew in the early 80s through the 90s, that actually had an interesting effect on people's willingness to come out. More people started coming out as the AIDS crisis became more and more part of the public consciousness.
Yes, AIDS really was a very transformative, devastating, and yet almost in an ironic way, an organizing tool. You couldn't avoid coming out when you and your friends, you know, then developed this at first unknown disease, and then as it became clear that it was HIV, and all of the stigma and potential discrimination that would come from that really forced a lot of us to become much more public and much more organized.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes it was personal. I was going to funerals all the time, and I said to myself, I can't just sit in the newspaper office and put in obituaries. I have to go, and I ended up doing work
and
for I was
Hero. You were working at the
I was working paper, at right. the AIDS Administration, but then I worked for Hero, and Hero was one of the first organizations in the country. That was 1984 that they began.
I was involved in both Governor Hughes's and Governor Schaefer's AIDS commissions, and we were faced with many people wanting to do mandatory testing, and we were concerned that if we went down that road, which may have been a good public health effort, it did mean that people would then be subject to possible discrimination. And so that sort of energized us to say we've got to build in protections. It made the gay rights ordinance that eventually passed in 1980 a really essential piece of legislation because of the ever-growing stigma and discrimination that people were facing, whether you had HIV or not.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is it was the third try to get that legislation passed? And see, what was the thing that tipped the balance?
Well, the first thing we did was decide, since Stu Burns decided he was going to lie and not support the bill when he said he would, is that we needed to get a candidate that we could trust. And so a lot of lesbian and gay people went out to work for Kurt Schmoke's election through the Lesbian and Gay Democratic Club and through other means, and to get Mary Pat Clark back in there and as president of the city council. But we also did this sophisticated lobbying effort that we'd never done before because people were energized. The 1987 March on Washington brought a new energy to everybody. They just got fed up. And also, we had a great time making fun of the bigots because, for example, there was Mimi DiPietro on the Baltimore City Council, and he was talking about, we got good gays in Baltimore. They don't want this bill. And we would just look at each other and be stunned. He was in an elevator with Ann Gordon, who was a member of the Justice Campaign. And he looked at her and he said, see them gays? And she looked back at him and said, I am them gays. And he said, good people, good people.
We had the
time, people just didn't want to be like Mimi DiPietro. They didn't want to show up like that.
We had the unique ability to bring together three very disparate groups to oppose this bill, black Muslims, Orthodox, Jewish community, and evangelicals. I think it's the only time they ever came together.
It's quite the coalition, isn't it?
It is. and we did have it was a very sophisticated campaign, but it wasn't up until the very last minute because I remember Mary Pat Clark telling me that on the very last day when we had been through two readers, you know, the Catholic Church had weighed in. It's been passed twice.
If you get to the third reader, pretty sure you're going to get the
bill.
You
should be in. But it took a lot of political courage again in 1988 from those members of the city council. And as Louise said, led by Mary Pat Clark. And we knew we had Kurt Schmoke's promise to sign the bill. So that actually gave an impetus. Most legislators aren't going to vote for something they know is not going to pass. They're not going to put their neck on the line. And so having Kurt's support allowed us to go back to those individual members and say, yes, you're taking a very serious political risk, but it's going to pay off.
And we also had people coming in and being bigoted and showing their hatred and spewing it all over the city council. And the city council members were sitting there going, you know, we don't need to see proof that there's bias against LGBT people because they're doing it right in front of us.
Okay. Louise Parker Kelly is the author of a new book on the history of the gay rights movement called LGBT Baltimore. Kurt Decker is with us in the studio as well. He's the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network and a longtime gay rights activist in Baltimore and beyond. Kurt, you were involved right from the very beginning with a study out of Hopkins called SHARE, the study to help AIDS research efforts. Began in 1982. Tell about how this was organized and what the purpose of this study, which is still ongoing.
Yes. Dr. Frank Polk, a fantastic researcher who has since passed away, approached me in 1982 and said that he'd gotten a grant from the NIH to try to figure out what was happening to these gay men across the country who were dying from an unexplained series of diseases. And
this is before people were aware of HIV.
Yes,
and the causes of AIDS, et cetera.
HIV wasn't really identified until 1985, and we were well into the study by then. And so he asked me to help him find 1,200 gay men to participate in the study, which was daunting in a city like Baltimore. Just to give you an example, we had asked Frank to take the study to Union Memorial, the sports clinic, as a way of making people feel more comfortable. They initially agreed, and when the House resident doctors heard that there was going to be this gay health study, they reneged on the contract. And so we ended up going back to Hopkins, where that study has gone on.
And this will continue for the foreseeable future, right?
As it turned out, it was one of the first studies to identify HIV. And it was an interesting position because Dr. Polk came to us and said, I know the HIV status of everybody in this study. What do I do with that information? And it was a pretty difficult discussion about whether you share this information with people when there was no treatment or potential cure at that time.
And what did they decide?
We decided that people should have the right to know. I would say in retrospect, I think now we realize that probably we should have mandated that people be told because of the ability to transmit it. But we were, again, in that very incredible period of the balance between discrimination and information.
Mm-hmm. And Louise Parker Kelly, you write about the communities of color who were involved in the gay rights movement. What have been the particular challenges for them?
I had a personal experience of it because I was part of GLCCB, and every so often
the Gay and Lesbian Community Center.
And every so often we would have an election, and the men would look around at each other and say, oh, we don't have enough people of color. We don't have enough women. And they'd turn to me and say, go find us some candidates in the community. Now, there were always people, always, all along at the community center who were people of color, who were leaders and participating. But every once in a while, there didn't seem to be enough people. And I finally got fed up one day because John turned to me. John was the president and said, you know, we really do need to have somebody from the black community as a delegate at large. Could you go find someone? And I said, John, why don't you go look in your living room? And if you don't have anybody there, what does that say? Because I don't want to keep doing this. We need to create relationships. And to his credit and to the credit of many of the men that worked at the community center, they did that. But I think the black gay community in Baltimore was faced with the double whammy. And the people who stepped forward were among some of the strongest and most impressive people I have ever met.
Kurt Decker, you have worked for the last three decades or more as the head of the disability, the largest advocacy organization for disability rights. It's an interesting intersection between rights of the disabled and rights of the LGBT community and moving forward. A lot of people have commented, for example, with the Supreme Court decision. What's the next step for the gay community as we move forward from this Supreme Court decision earlier this summer?
I do believe that the next step has to be then building in this protection of discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodation, as Baltimore did in 1988. I mean, I think it's important to realize that Baltimore was actually in the forefront of doing this, along with some other cities. But it wasn't until just a few years ago that the state passed that kind of non-discrimination bill. And now that we need to expand that at a national level. Because as you said, now that people are free to get married and come out, that actually can put them at risk. And we're seeing stories across the country where teachers and other people are losing their jobs by virtue of getting married. And so we want to make sure that potential of that victory isn't sullied by, you know, further discrimination.
And then people were told, like Maggie McIntosh, Delegate Maggie McIntosh helped pass the bill. She was told, don't step out on this issue, marriage equality. It'll cost you the election. You know, Mary Washington faced the same thing. It's a sensation that people have that if we are upfront about, yes, we need national protection, then you, as a politician, could lose your job.
And I think the other forefront now is transgendered issues and sexual identity issues, which are related and need to be addressed as well. And it is interesting to see how quickly public opinion is changing in this very fast social media world.
Many gains and with a rapidity that probably nobody could have predicted 5 years ago even. This book is a terrific read and it's got some beautiful
photographs.
It's a nice
beginning.
Yeah.
There's lots more to be told.
All right. Well, thanks to you both. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Kurt Decker is the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. He's been active in the gay rights movement locally and nationally for many years. Louise Parker Kelly is the author of a new book in the Images of Modern America series. It's published by Arcadia Publishing. The book is called LGBT Baltimore, and we've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/ Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. After a break, some sounds from the Charm City Labor Chorus.
Oh, yeah.
Stay with us.